much have used the idea of humaneness towards animals as a justification for prohibiting shechita. There are countries in Europe where shechita is absolutely prohibited. Yeah.
What is their argument?
Huh?
What is their argument?
Shechita is inhumane to animals.
Well, what is their method of killing
their
the
method?
Animals?
The method is that you knock them over the head, you stun them, you give them electric shocks, the race was, you know. So those are humane. But if you do shechita, that is inhumane. Obviously, I mean, shechita is not inhumane, it's humane, but they're not interested in logic. They're interested only in making service for Eden. So in those countries, the only way you can get kosher meat is to import it from a country where shechita is permitted.
They were going
to
do it here at Tim's.
Yeah, that's right. So therefore, you know, it presents big problems. And our rabbis have to be on the alert to make sure that if there's any legislation, it's not going to infringe upon the method of shechita that we observe.
Is shechita always done by hand, or are there machines that...
No, it's not allowed to. It has to be done by hand, because how else can you control
the movement of the
animal? Right. I mean, the animal, I mean, can be shackled to a certain extent. After all, you don't want it, you know, to give you a kick in the kishkas or something at the time when you're trying to kill it, you know. But, but nevertheless, it requires human, as we would say in the Lashon and the Gemara, it requires koach gabra. In other words, you have to have human strength that's involved in it.
Does the animal keep moving after?
Yes.
How long does the cow
keep? For a few seconds or something like that. This is what is called pirkus. Incidentally, this is considered a test to determine whether the animal is a healthy animal or not. If it has a reflex action, exactly. So, it's again, you know, shechita is not, there are plenty of rules and regulations concerning it, you know. And then, of course, what happens after the animal has been slaughtered? You have the next step, which is what we would call the bedikah, where you have to examine the internal organs also to make sure that, you know, they're whole. And of course, particularly, the problem is as far as the lungs are concerned, because it's quite common, you know, to have a perforation in the lung, and that would automatically make the animal trapheal. So if there's an adhesion on the lung, the adhesion has to be removed in order to make sure that there's no perforation underneath it. This is what we call the difference between kosher and glatt kosher. The glatt kosher means that the lung is smooth and there are no adhesions.
But that's really an American invention. There was no such thing as glatt kosher in Europe.
Yeah, I would say that that's probably so. I wouldn't say it's an American invention.
And the fact of the matter is that if you go look into it, all the meat is glutton.
Yeah, Hungarians particularly.
Everything is
glutton.
Hungary.
All the meat is glutton.
Lycia, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say
Carpathia. In that area of Eastern Europe. And, you know, they brought over these ideas to this country. And, you know, today, if you eat kosher, it's not good enough. You have to eat glatt kosher.
They tried to tackle the Oreo kosher market competitively. When a competitor opened up, there was a big issue in Del Rey saying that they were not handling glatt kosher meat.
I have it on good authority that all the meat is glatt kosher. All the meat is glatt kosher, because otherwise it wouldn't be kosher.
Well, no, you describe it differently. If it's kosher, it can be kosher, but not.
Right.
It
has to be examined. Okay.
Well,
but at any rate.
What I'm trying to say is that it's all examined.
Yeah,
it's all examined.
Yes.
If it's kosher, it's all examined.
That is correct. It has to be examined. You have to make sure that that's
not all. You're not saying that all.
Yeah.
All kosher meat.
That's what I was told. All the meat that's slaughtered is
all kosher meat in the United States is glatt kosher.
I'm sorry.
Irv is saying that he was given to understand that all kosher meat in the United States is glatt kosher.
No.
I didn't think so.
No, it's not.
That's why they made a big issue.
They made a big issue out of that.
Publicly, the difference of the glatt and kosher. I'm no expert.
Today, in the kosher slaughter, if they put their hands and they find any kind of unevenness on the lung, they automatically give it to the trade. So everything that they do pass as kosher is glatt.
I don't know whether that's so.
But that's what I was told.
I don't know.
That's what I was told.
Somebody has to have the expertise to go to the additional step of understanding.
Because it costs money to have the expertise. But the point is that the slaughterer has to do the inspection, right?
Right, right.
Okay?
Now, in a big slaughterhouse, by the way, what they do is that they have some who are simply for shechita and others who do only dig.
That doesn't make sense, sure.
Yeah.
But
because it would be too costly from an economic standpoint, it would be too costly to start examining it, to find out if it knocked off the perforation, if there is a perforation, if there's an ulcer on the lung or something. It takes too much time. Economically, it's not feasible. If there's any kind of unevenness to the lung. It's considered trade.
Well,
it makes sense economically.
See, the point is, I have not been to a slaughterhouse over here in quite some time, so we don't have slaughterhouses.
That's what I was told. I didn't go to a slaughterhouse either, but that's what I was told.
They're doing the shechita today out in the Midwest, and then they bring in the meat, you know, by freight or whatever it is, you know. Refrigeration, you know, and they bring it to the very
then how
spicy.
Do all these people who sold black kosher meat in New York or anywhere else know that it's black kosher?
The answer is that it's supposed to be examined to make sure that it's black kosher. Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. As far as I know, the nearest black kosher slaughterhouse is someplace in New Jersey. But I remember, you know, when I was studying, you know, years ago, they used to have slaughterhouses in New York. I went in and I saw the process over there, shechita, the bedikah, and so on and so forth. And they had a chart. Each animal was given a number, and if they found something that was wrong in it, so they would put down, you know, the number on the blackboard over there, and automatically that was given over to the goyim.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that was the procedure in those days. But I saw, I mean, that the boydik was actually, he was blowing it up, you know, like they have for the balloons, you know, the little jet of air.
They put it in water to see if there's water.
Like you put a fire in water.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
Then you'll see if there's a puncture.
If you see that it bubbles over there, and in that case,
that's exactly what I'm saying. To do all that is a costly. It takes time, and it's economically not feasible. So if there's any kind of question, automatically goes to go.
But I don't know whether they work on that basis. Not to dwell on the subject right now.
I've seen it recently in LA that at the kosher market there was a furor about it, and the kosher Jewish restaurants, so that they were putting up signs. We carry only glatt kosher meat.
Right.
But they were putting up special signs. They were kosher restaurants. They were kosher restaurants. All right.
And because people who are very particular today insist that they want to eat only glatt kosher.
Yeah.
But I told Irv, I had an experience at Shea Joseph this past Sunday where they served glatt kosher meat. And somebody comes over to me and says, where did you get the meat? So I told him, you know, what the source was, the shechita was. He says, I'm not happy because there is glatt kosher and glatt kosher.
There we go.
I mean, yeah, okay.
So my homer is better than your homer.
My fingers feel better than your fingers.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay, getting back to the Gemara then.
Right, exactly. Let's go back to the Gemara.
That's right. So the best thing to say is glatt kosher.
Right. All right. We see that there is then this conflict between the rabbis and the Rabbi Shimon, right?
Right.
Because Rabbi Shimon says that chenek chomer misayim. He says that strangulation is a much more severe penalty than decapitation. Okay? Sayat, of course, means sword, but in this case it means, you know, that they
lop off.
They lop it off with the sword, right. So, he says, Shigiga Sayat Nitol Chapar. He says, if a person. Now, for example, when does the Torah prescribe that the penalty is death? By, and we say it's, you know, that the punishment is by sword, it's for a murderer. Okay? So, he says, if a person committed murder, right, but he did it shigigas, in other words, by, you know, inadvertently, as we said, as we've been explaining.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that particular case, he says, nitol chapora, we have the opportunity for kapara, in other words, we have the opportunity for atonement. Which way? Through golus,
right?
Now we said the golus bechaperus, right? Okay, but shigagas chenek says, if a person commits a crime where the punishment should be chenek, and specifically what we're referring to in our case over here is what? The father striking. The son striking the father, and the father dies. So in that particular case, he says, "Lo nitol chapora." That, for that, there is no atonement.
Hmm.
I mean, he should have been more careful, you know, with his father, and you know, not kill him even inadvertently, right?
Okay.
But on the other hand, the rabbanon, as far as the rabbis are concerned, the amri sayet chol mecherek, who say that decapitation is a more severe penalty than strangulation. So in that case, horeg oviv, if somebody kills his father, right, then shigagat sayefu, it is a penalty. He deserves a death penalty through decapitation, but since it's inadvertent, right? So therefore, v'shigaga saif niton chapora, and as we said before, if he deserves, you know, execution through the sword, but it was inadvertent, so therefore, an opportunity was given for atonement. So in that case, then that's why the Mishnah says what? That the habein al ho'ov, right? Habein gol al yidei ho'ov, that the son will go into golus. If he kills inadvertently his father. So we have two different points of view. All right. Then along came Rava. Mm-hmm. Rava Omar, and he says, Prat li osech habura biyoviv bishoykin. He says, I have to exclude what the Mishnah says, you know, that he deserves golus, if a person actually causes a wound or inflicts a wound upon his father inadvertently. Salkadate chamino, you might think that I say that kevin b'mezid bar katolahu, right, that if he had done it purposely, then he deserves a death penalty. But bishogeg nami ligle, so likewise then, if he does it inadvertently, he should go into golus. So, kamash malon, for this reason, we learn that what? We learn that we still haven't resolved the question as to whether we should follow the Mishnah and say that he's entitled to go into golus,
yeah,
or whether we should follow Rabbi Shimon and say that he doesn't deserve the opportunity for kapara. Doesn't mean he's going to be necessarily put to death for it. But it means that he's given no protection, and if somebody else in the family wants to go and kill him or something like that, then it's revenge.
Justified.
So we justify. Okay, I think we will stop at this particular point. And my voice, Baruch Hashem, managed to last for this hour. So
Okay, so we meet next week?
We'll meet next week, as usual.
So we're now at the bottom of
who inadvertently causes a wound on his father, as he wounds his father inadvertently, so he doesn't go into Golis. Okay? He might, what shall we say, theoretically deserve it because he had no, but because it was inadvertent, so therefore he does not go into Golis. It's only, if he happened to kill his father inadvertently that he would have to go into Golis, but not if he wounds his father. But on the other hand, if he deliberately wounded his father, then for that we have a pasuk in the Torah that says specifically that, he deserves the death penalty. Make over v'yimo, most you must. Part of the problem is, of course, the fact...
Even if it's inadvertent?
No.
If he did it purposely,
yeah. He purposely hit his father. Problem is also the fact that, what does the word make mean?
Hit.
It could mean hit, but make could also mean to kill.
Yeah.
Right. So, the point is, where it says, Maki Nefesh Pishgogo, we're talking all this time, about the person, who is going to get Golis, and in order to protect him, from the Goel Adam, if he killed inadvertently, but there was also a certain amount of negligence that was involved in it, right? So, Maki means that he kills him. But, Maki Obibi Yimo Mos Yumos, there it doesn't mean kill. Obviously, if he would kill his father and his mother deliberately, there's no question he would have done it. But the point is, if he strikes his father or his mother, he deserves the death penalty, but the sages come and say, only if he inflicts a wound upon them. If he only hit them but did not wound them, then in that case he would not kill. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that he deserves the Yashikriyah for it, obviously not.
Yeah.
But he would not get the death penalty under those circumstances. All right, so
we are now
right towards the bottom of Daf Ches Amud Beis. They now quote Hakol Gol Nei Yisrael. All right, that's approximately 7-8 lines from the bottom.
Yeah,
okay,
right here.
Yeah.
So could you repeat the
yes? Okay, the Mishnah continued by saying Hakol Gol Nei Yisrael. Right? In other words, anybody will go into exile for inadvertently killing a Jew. Of course, the question is, who are we talking about? And a Jew, Yisrael, right? Goylan al Yedehen, would go into exile because he inadvertently killed them. Chutz Meger Toshav, except for the Ger Toshav. This is what it says so far. And we define the word Ger Toshav as a person who remains a goy, is not converted to Judaism. However, he lives in Eretz Yisrael by virtue of the fact that he agrees to abide by the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, that he's going to abide by the seven commandments of B'nei Noach, which of course include various things, including, not to murder, not to steal, that believe in enforcing the law through Bote Dinin, also that he's prohibited from worshipping an idol over there, as long as he's a Ger Toshav, and one of the other things, he's also prohibited from eating an Eifer Menachai. He's not allowed to tear a limb from an animal and eat that, because that's one of the mitzvahs that the B'nai Noach were commanded that they're not allowed to do. Naturally, another thing that B'nai Noach have to observe would be family purity. I mean, in the sense that, not to commit adultery.
Right.
Okay, so that's Shpichas Domim, bloodshed, and Gilui Arroyos. This is prohibited to the B'nai Noach, just as they are prohibited to a Jew. Okay.
B'nai Noach were not Jews, though, were they?
B'nai Noach were not Jews, no. I mean, Noach himself was not a Jew.
Right.
I mean, he's our friend. He occupies a lot of space in the Torah, but still,
he wasn't Jewish,
technically
yeah.
He wasn't a Jew. Hmm. The one who was the first Jew, that should be Abraham Avinu.
Abraham Avinu.
Okay. But still, Noach was not an idolater either, you see. Yeah. And obviously his sons too, you know, were commanded not to be idolaters, and etc., etc. I mean, the things that I mentioned before, which is the Gemara in Sanhedrin delineates what are the Shiva Mitzvahs. So along came the Gemara in Avodah Zorah and says, so tell me, did the Goyim really observe the Shiva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach?
Gemara asked that.
Gemara asked
the question.
Right. So the answer is that for the most part they didn't. They did what they felt like. Okay. So, but nevertheless, as we say, a Ger Toshav is technically, and if he wants to live in Eretz Yisrael, then this is part of the, what shall I say, the social contract that he has to undertake.
It's abide by the rules of the land.
Oh, it has to, exactly.
This would apply to, let's say, the Arab living.
So that, of course, is to be distinguished from the word ger in the sense of a ger tzedek, a person who adopts Judaism, he converts to Yiddishkeit, in which case he's a Jew itself. Okay. Now we'll also see, however, that if you remember, based on the Gemara and Kedusha that we studied a long time ago, but we're still a little fresh in our memory. There we have other people too that we have to consider, namely a Kusi and an Eved. And they're going to figure in the Gemara right now, because the Gemara now continues, and it says, "Hakol Golin Al Yedei Yisrael." Right? It says everybody will go into exile by inadvertently killing a Jew. Right? So the Gemara wants to know, what does the word Hakol include? Cami. What is included by it? We're 7 lines from the bottom, right?
7 from the bottom?
7 from the bottom.
A clue going, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Who would this include? When it says everybody. Can everybody really mean everybody? That's what the question is. So they say it includes the Suye, Eved, the Kusi. That includes also a slave, and also a Kusi. Now here, the slave that we're talking about is not an Eved Yisrael. It's not an Eved Ivri. He's not a Jew. Because if he were, you know, a Jew, he simply sold himself into slavery in order to satisfy debts that he incurred as a result of Ganeva, whatever it may be. So he's still a Jew, there's no question. Not only that, but as the Gemara says, you know, that his balabas, his adon, master, is obliged to have him live the style of living that he was accustomed to before he sold himself into slavery.
Good way to go.
He was used to, for example, sleeping on a down pillow, then the master has to provide him with a down pillow. If he was used to eating, you know, all kinds of goodies, the master has to provide him with that. And of course, we also learned, you know, that his wife and his children all have to be taken care of by the master. So, as the Gemara says that Koine Evet, you know, Koine Oda Neyatzmo, somebody acquires a slave of this category, so he's really acquiring a master, a boss over him. It's like many a person who owns a business and is convinced that he works harder than his employees. He's working really in order to try to take
the early Well, I can say, I'm not used to working so hard. I thought,
you're right.
You can't make me work so hard.
Right. You cannot make him one, but incidentally, do things that were considered bizoya. Bizoya means, you know, that he is disgraced as a result. For example, he's not allowed to carry his things into the bathhouse, because that was already reserved for more menial types. Okay?
You gotta have a slave to bring it in.
Right. But, you know, this would be diminishing his social status even as a slave. So. Now, of course, we have another type of slave, and that's what we call the Eved Kenani, literally the Canaanite slave, okay? Now, the Eved, why is it called Kenani? Because it's written, you know, in the Torah that, you know, a person is permitted to take from the people who lived in Canaan, you know, and let's say buy them as slaves, keep them as slaves, sell them as slaves, whatever it is, okay. But he has his obligation towards them too. And here we are dealing with an Eved Kenani. Because obviously, the Eved Ivri, it goes without saying that if he killed an Eved Ivri, there's no question that he has to go into Galus, right? Because he's killing a fellow Jew, that's all. So what about the Eved Kenani? The answer with the Eved Kenani is that his status is as sort of a Jew, but still an inferior status. The master is, of course, obliged to do what? The answer is, one thing, he has to circumcise him. Has to circumcise him, you know, not only circumcise him, but also bring him to the mikveh as well, okay? If he would buy a female, you know, shifcha kananis, as we would say, in that case he has to convert her also by taking her to the mikveh. Obviously he can't circumcise her. Okay. Female circumcision was unheard of among Jews, okay. Even though practiced in Africa.
Practiced by the Muslim. You know.
Right, right. Many of them still do.
Nani is actually...
He is a Jew for certain purposes. Yeah, right, right.
Can you convert him?
Correct. It's like semi-conversion, okay. Why do I say semi-conversion? Because a full-fledged Jew, such as the Eved Ivri, is obliged to do all the mitzvahs, okay? And Eved Kenani has to observe the mitzvahs leisase, right? But any mitzvahs ase which depend upon time for the fulfillment, so that he is excused because he has to attend to his master's needs. In other words, in this particular category, he has really a situation which is somewhat analogous to the rule concerning women. Okay? But nevertheless, just as in the case of women, as we learned when we studied in Kedusha, that Rabbeinu Tam in Tosfos says specifically that not only can a woman undertake to perform any mitzvah, which is dependent upon time if she so feels like it, but even if she should make a bracha, it would not be a bracha de batala, which was, you know, an objection that some people would have raised, you see. So that if a woman, for example, wants to hear the blowing of the shofar, there's no question. She has the obligation to hear the blowing of the shofar, even though it's dependent upon time, right? A woman, if she wants to take a lulav and an esrog and make the bracha over it, it's perfectly proper for her to do it, even though it was the men, technically, who were commanded to do it. The same thing with sitting in the sukkah. If she wants to sit in the sukkah, she can sit in the sukkah and say the bracha leishi basukkah, even though, technically, it's the men who are commanded to sit in the sukkah, not the men. By the way, among many of the Galatians, they don't let the women in the sukkah. Women are there in order to serve their husbands and such.
Would you have to observe Lachitza in the sukkah under those conditions?
Would you have to do
have Lachitza in your sukkah?
No, no. Of course, they're not they're not davening in the sukkah. Well, I guess maybe if you were above the chosid or something like that.
Well, I know some people that some people who haven't seen them.
Who did you write this dean about Galatianas?
About what?
Galatianas. That the wives are not.
All right.
In this
so I'm going to tell you right now. It happened to me. It happened to me. Okay.
All right.
And as you probably know, was born in Galicia.
Oh my God.
What do you say? Believe me, she had wonderful parents, a father and a mother. When my father saw them, he said, "Sazevi Abba Homan Sora." That's how they impressed him. You know, they were very, very fine people. Don't have to tell
why
you
how
they were and everything else, okay? It's a little, don't take it seriously, this rivalry between Litvox and Galicianos, okay? And America certainly has very little input today. But our oldest sister is married to a Bayana chassid. I mean, both
what?
Of them now are gone.
What kind of chassid?
Bayana. Never heard of Bayana? Bayana Rav is a famous Rav.
Heard about that?
It's a famous Rav in the, I guess from about 1920 on until its death. No. But of course, he came from a dynasty that had been in the town of Bayan. But originally, they were from Rizhin. Yisrael Rizhiner is a very famous founder of all kinds of dynasties. And one of the dynasties that came out of Rizhin is Bayan, okay? The previous Bayan Rav was a very, very famous person. He's very active in the Agudas Yisrael, one of the founders, active in resettlement of Jews from Europe and things like that. Originally he was in Vienna, you know, after he left Bayan, and eventually came to this country. And he was in the Lower East Side of New York. And he lived in New York. So at any rate, my brother-in-law was a Bayana chassid. And by the way, his son and sons-in-law and so on, they're still a Bayana chassid, okay? So I remember we went to one sukkah to visit over there. And mentioned, you know, that he would sit in the sukkah, you know, as she comes in. And he said, what? You let a woman into the sukkah? He said. So I said, what's the matter? He said, women, they're only there in order to bring the food.
Hey, babe. Real chauvinist, huh?
You missed that question. That's an example of the Haratna cult. Wow. From one person, you derive the deen encompassing the whole population of
general, but I'll tell you another story.
And all of this
I'll tell you another story.
They live in America.
There are Lubavitch and my brother Harold dines with them, where they don't allow the women to eat in the same room with them.
Where is this?
Where do you
live?
In New York?
I'm telling you, Worcester.
In Worcester. Yeah.
I saw that in China.
They don't allow the women to eat in a separate room.
When is this? We're talking about
Shabbos.
I've never seen this.
Tell me.
In the same room?
Look,
no, not
I guess
same
it
room.
Can have degrees of fanaticism.
They
what
eat,
am I going to say?
Maybe in the kitchen, and the men's eat in the dining room.
In
you know?
China, the women are not allowed.
Never seen that. But the Babich, they always.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I mean, the Lubavitcher that we see over here, we normally consider them as being more liberal.
You know, there are various degrees of these Machmir guys, you know.
No, this is true. All right. So getting back now to what we're on.
Okay.
That's all right. Even what we say, not on the text, is worthwhile.
All right. Now we understand what the why we
the Morris says that a filo sichat chulin shall talbid chacham tzricha talmud, or another one tzricha libd, which means that even the idle conversation of a talmud chacham, you have to learn it, you have to study it.
Yeah, true.
You got it.
I got it. I'll
well,
tell you.
Okay, I'll just leave that.
Okay. All right. So, the Eved over here then is the Eved Kanani, okay? Which, as we see, he has the status of being like Jewish in that, you know, he is Gemal, he's Ketevel, right? And he has to observe all kinds of mitzvahs except those positive commandments which are dependent upon time, okay? So, he is, for all purposes, a Jew. And yet, we learned from the Gemara in Kedushin that at the same time, an Eved cannot marry a Yisraelis. Cannot marry her. Okay? Why? Because it's considered a come down. It's not the same Yichus. So, that's the reason why, as we see over here, his status is only, you know, like semi accepted, shall we say. Okay? Now the kusi we've spoken about many times. We had that also, of course, in the Gemara Kiddushim. But I mention it again from time to time that these were the Samaritans, people who were settled in Eretz Yisrael by Sancheirib after he conquered the 10 tribes of Israel, and they were brought from the furthest regions of the Assyrian Empire, including a place called Kusa. That's how you get the name Kusim, okay? But there are other places that we mentioned too in the Book of Kings. And they settled in northern Israel, and they mixed with what Jewish population was still left over there. In other words, not every single Jew went into exile. People did stay. But, you know, the what shall we say, the aristocracy, the most learned groups, the skilled craftsmen, and so on and so forth, those were the people primarily who were taken by Sancheir and scattered to the furthest reaches of the Assyrian Empire so that they should be assimilated and never again, you know, hope to reconstruct their life in Eretz Israel, okay? And to this day, we're still looking for the 10 tribes, you know, who were exiled by Sancheir, okay? Babylonians had a somewhat similar policy in that, if you remember, if you read the Book of Kings, you see that in approximately the year 597, prior to the Common Era, Nebuchadnezzar exiled to Babylonia many of the leading Jews in Yerushalayim and in Yehuda and so on and so forth, including among them, for example, Yehezkel, the prophet, and but you know many others. Also it says Harash, Hamaska, in other words, all kinds of skilled craftsmen, they were also exiled over there. But otherwise he still left people in Eretz Yisrael under a vassal king who was Sidkiyahu, and then when Sidkiyahu rebelled against him some 10 years later, so this is when eventually the Beis HaMikdash was finally destroyed. And then the Babylonian exile really was a very severe one. Besides, who knows how many thousands perished, but also they exiled thousands and thousands.
But the Jews,
and still there were Jews who left, if you remember.
But those Babylonian Jews apparently survived.
Yes, Jews who were in Babylonia survived.
Right.
In other words, conditions at first were not so ayayay because they knew they were in an enemy land. This is why we say, in Psalm 137, you know, Al Naroth Bobel, by the rivers of Babylonia, right? There, Sham Yashavnu, Gabachinu, there we sat and we wept when we remembered Zion. And then, of course, Imesh Kotheif Yerushalayim, you know, Tishkach Imini, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand lose its cunning, and so on. And let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, you know, if I forget thee, if I do not raised Jerusalem above any joy of my own. That's the way it was. But eventually, many people, you know, they struck roots in Babylonia. And as a matter of fact, the prophet Yirmiyahu, who survived the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash, and who remained with the people in Judea in order to try to encourage them that they should continue living over there. He wrote to the people in Babylonia, to the Jews living over there, and he told them, pray for the welfare of the city in which you dwell, because in its welfare you will find welfare. And he tells them, you know, to marry, have children, and so on and so forth. So that, you know, in other words, he's encouraging them, you know, to live a normal life. And this is what happened. This was the origins, of course, of the what later became one of the largest Jewish areas of population.
They remained strong. They remained strong to their faith, the ones that were exiled to the...
Yeah, right. Look, it's possible that there were Jews who assimilated, but we don't know about that. We only know about the Jews who remained loyal, because it was from this group eventually too that 40,000 volunteered in the days of King Cyrus of Persia after he conquered Babylonia to go back to Eretz Israel and started to try to rebuild the land. All right. So the Kusim, as we said, they mixed with the population in Israel, in northern Israel. But while they consider themselves Jewish and they adopted many Jewish practices, but at the same time they still observed practices of their own which to us were idolatrous in nature. This we learned in Kedushin, and the Gemara and the Chulin that says, you know, that when they examined the temple of the Samaritans, so they found that they were worshipping Dumus Yonah, a figure of a dove that they were worshipping it. So naturally under that, in those circumstances, since they were worshipping to an idol, so they were declared to be Ovdei Avodah Zarah. But still we have a general rule that we find again and again in various places in the Talmud that says that mitzvah Shechazikabo Kusim Hezikabo Yosef Yisrael. In other words, any mitzvah of the Torah that the Kusim did observe, they kept it even more carefully, shall we say, than an Israelite. Yeah. I mean, one example would be, I mean, let's say, subsequently you have with the Karaites too, that there were many ways they thought of the Kusim, in that they did not believe in our oral tradition. And so the Bible says, Lo sabaru eish b'chol mashveseichem b'yom ha-shabbos, literally, you shall not burn fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. So taka, they kept it literally. Namely, there were no fires, no lights, no nothing in their homes on Shabbos. Whereas we have an oral tradition that explains that whatever you prepare Erev Shabbos, you can make use of on Shabbos in this particular case. And not only that, but it became accepted as a mitzvah for a woman to light the Sabbath lamps. Well, so that, as the Gemara says, I mean, it should be, the Gemara in Shabbos says, it's for the sake of Shalom Bayis, that there should be peace in the household. So that's why. So you see, our attitude is quite different from theirs. But there are other mitzvahs that they kept very carefully, and you know, Jews were told to emulate them in that particular respect. All right. But again, they were considered, I mean, Jewish and not Jewish. You see. So these are the people now that the Gemara is saying, you know, La Suye Mai, La Suye Eved Bekusi. It's to include a Canaanite slave or a Kusi. In other words, what? If an Israelite killed either an Eved or a Kusi, right? Inadvertently, then what? Then he's to go into Golis. Needless to say, if he killed any of them purposely, then he deserves the death penalty. That's no question. Right. But we're talking about inadvertently what happens. Okay?
I have a question.
Sure.
Is there a difference between a deen and a chope?
Between a deen and a chope?
Interchangeable?
Yeah, you know, they're not interchangeable exactly. I mean, if we're looking, you know, for technical differences, a chok or a chukot, this is the kind of a law which the people of Israel were commanded to observe by the Rabbeinu Shel Olam without necessarily giving a reason for it. Okay, this is the way we understand it. As for example, you know, one of the prime examples is the Poradum, okay? But even Kashrus could be considered in the same category as being, you know, a chok or a chuk. In other words, we are commanded to do it, okay? Now, Din is a word, you know, which could be subject to interpretation in various ways. Okay? One interpretation, of course, of din is the fact that people have a machlokes, they have an argument between each other, so that's a good, they go. They go to the Beis Din in order to settle the argument, okay? And what is the din? The din is then the judgment, the verdict, you know, that the Beis Din issues in order to try to resolve the issue. So this is one meaning of the word din. But another meaning of the word din is that, for example, you want to know whether this practice is correct or this practice is correct or something, and you look it up, let's say, in the Shulchan Aruch. So you say, there's a din in the Shulchan Aruch that says blank, 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 blank. Okay? So there we're using it in the sense, you know, that this is considered an accepted opinion in the Shulchan Aruch, that this is the practice, the way it should be observed. Okay? So it all depends, you know, how you understand it. So. And then, of course, I mean, we have Mishpat, which is defined as being the kind of a law that logic would tell us that it has to be observed also, as for example, not to steal, not to murder, and so on, you know, this is a Mishpat, okay? All right. So, he says, Tanin Loho, the Tan Rabban, and he says, we have a Baraisa which gives support, you know, to our interpretation of what we've just realized by saying that it's the Evan Kusi, you know, who are included in this when it says Hakol. The Tan Rabban, as we have this Baraisa which teaches us, Evid the Kusi, Goyle Veloika Al Yudei Yisrael, right? That a Canaanite slave or a Kusi would go into exile, or they would receive Malkas if, you know, the victim of their action was a Jew, right? Yisrael Goyle Veloika Al Yudei Kusi Vieda. And likewise, a Jew would go into exile or would receive Malkas by what he did to a Kusi or an Eved. Okay. Now, of course, already we see that there is a slight contradiction between the Mishnah and here, because the Mishnah that we have just a couple of lines above does not mention anything about Loka, about getting Malkas.
It's not mentioned, it's only
mentioned about Gola.
Right.
But here the Baraisa says not only Gola, but it also adds the word Loki. So, the Gemara says, Bishlam ho'eved v'kusi Gola al yaday Yisrael. Okay, I can understand that an Eved or a Kusi would go into exile if they inadvertently killed an Israelite. Okay, they are getting this protection to go to the to the Ir Miklat, to the city of refuge, right?
Right.
Gola de Katle, right? He says he would go into exile if he killed him. The Loke, and he would receive Malkas de Lataye, if he would curse a Jew. If the Eved or the Kusi would curse a Jew, then he would get it. How do we know that if a person curses another person, that he deserves Malkas? So this we derive, Rashi explains how. Okay. All right. We can take it. Well, all right, let me summarize it for you. Second line from the bottom of the page, where it says, Loka Dilatai, right? That he gets Malkus if he curses him. Amin, and he says, Gemara and Shavuot says, that Hamakalil es Chaveiro, if somebody curses another person, right? Oyver Beleis Hasem, he is guilty of violating a negative commandment, a negative precept, if you wish, right? Violating a negative commandment. The Asya, and how do they derive it? They derive it the Mahatzad. Mahatzad means that I take a look at one passage, and then I take a look at another. Refers to a case of blank, blank, blank. So likewise over there too, it refers to a case of blank, blank, blank. All right. Mehamekalel. Mehamekalel dayan v'nosik v'chevesh. Says, we have the word mekalel, you know, somebody who curses, we have reference to cursing in the case of three different people mentioned in the Torah. One of them, it's written, Elohim lo sekalel. It's a pasuk, right, which says, you shall not curse. And here, Elohim is interpreted not just that you shouldn't curse God. I mean, that stands to reason. Okay. But the word Elohim, as we know, also refers to judges. Means that too. Mm. Because when we say, for example, every Tuesday morning, the Shir Shayom, Elohim, the Tzor Ba'adasel, the Kerv Elohim Yishpot. What does it mean, the Kerv Elohim Yishpot? It means over there that he judges among the judges. In other words, the Mishpot has to be correct in accordance with the spirit of what the Torah is, and God Himself will judge the judges as well to make sure that when they are rendering judges, when they are rendering justice, that the justice is in the spirit of Torah and law. Okay? Yeah. Well, it's not a form of idol worship, but it could be equated with it, okay? I mean, it's something that shouldn't be done. Particularly, by the way, we are talking about, you know, cursing and using God's name of the curse. As we know, a lot of people do, you know. Right. If you say, you know, the Rebbeinu Shalom Shadan, this or that, or something like that, you know. It's not the right thing to do, okay? Have to learn how to control our tongue a little bit, right? And so that's the dayon, right? The nosi, because the second part of the pasuk, Elohim lo sekalel, the nosi biyamcho lo soor, nor should you curse someone who is literally a prince among your people. All right, and then we have another pasuk which says lo sekalel cheresh. That you're not allowed to curse somebody who is deaf. Even though he is deaf and he cannot hear what you are saying, but morally it's wrong to curse someone who is deaf. Okay? And so therefore, inasmuch as the Torah has a law, you're not allowed to, right? And we know that in general, what is the punishment for somebody who violates what we would call a law, in other words, a negative commandment? The answer is the punishment very often is malchus. Okay? So that gives us now over here to understand, you know, that we're talking about, you know, why does it say golah? That we know, that's for a murder, right? But l'taye, if he curses, so that being a violation, as we've just shown from Rashi, so in that case he would be loka if he cursed, right? So getting back over here, in other words, if an Ebed or a Kusi, right, either killed inadvertently, who would go into, and then his punishment would be to go into Golas, or if he cursed, then he would receive Malchus. Okay? So how about the other side of the equation? Ela Yisrael goyle v'loike al yedei kusi. Now they're questioning, you know, the last part of the Baraisa, which says that the Jew would go into Golis or would receive Malkus because of what he did to a Kusi. So he says, Bishnamor Goyle the Katle. Okay, we can understand that he goes into Golis because he killed him inadvertently. Even if he was a Kusi, he had no business killing him, right? And of course, we're not talking about deliberate murder, we're talking about inadvertent murder. So he goes into Golis. Elo loke amai. But why should he get Malkus? You say dilataye, that because he cursed the Kusi? Doesn't the pasuk say v'nosi b'yamcho lo zohor, that you are not allowed to curse somebody who is a prince, literally, among your people? And how is it interpreted? It means b'eisa masi yamcho. We're talking when a person lives like a Jew 100%, then you're not allowed to curse him, right? So, obviously, if he's a Kusi who's not living 100% a Jewish life, partly Jewish, partly Goyish, and so on and so forth, right? So, why, if an Israelite cursed him, should he? So, obviously, the cursing part is out. So, when could a Jew get Malkus? Because of something that he did to a Kusi. This is the question. Okay? Since we're ruling out now cursing, in that case, so we have to find something else for which the Jew is going to get Malkus instead. So, Elo Omar Rav Acha Bar Yaakov. So, Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said, that is in the case of Kegon Sheheyid Bo Behuza. It's like a case where, let's say, the Jew testified against the Kusi, okay, and then the Jew, the Yisrael, was found to be what? He was an Eid Zomim, but he was giving false testimony. It's proved that he was a false, you know, he's giving false testimony. Right, so in that particular case, he's going to get Malkus, because if he had testified against the Kusi and he said, you know, that he violated something which you should get Malkus, and then we prove that in reality the Kusi hadn't done it, so he has to get Kasher Zomim Lassus Leyochiv, right? As he right, as he intended to do the other guy. So he gets Malkus. The Chavosei. Now, likewise, are we to say that Gabe Eved Sheheyid Bo Behuzam? Alright, we said, okay, it works for a Kusi. How about an Eved? Would it work for him? How could you say that when we say Eved Bar Edus Hu, right? That's a question. Eved Bar Edus Hu? Can we say that an Eved is permitted to give testimony? The answer is no, he can't give testimony. Well, if he can't give testimony, so how could you say that Huzan, that they challenged his testimony when he couldn't give testimony in the first place? So Elo Omar Rav Acha Bereda Rav Iko. So rather Rav Acha comes with a different solution. The son of this is Acha Bereda Rav Iko, who's not the same as Acha Bar Yaakov that we had two lines above. He says, Chochma Mayaskin, what kind of a case are we dealing with over here? He says, Kegon Sheyikohu Hakoh She'ein Bo Shevapruka. Okay. For example, he hit him, but the blow that he hit him, he hardly did any kind of harm to him. The amount of damage that he did to him is not even the equivalent of a pruta. In other words, when would the court assign punishment? Let's see, when would the court, you know, okay, if I were to hit you, okay, and let's say as a result of my blow, well, that already is, you know, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, I hit you and let's say you had to go to the doctor and it cost you, let's say $50 for the doctor's visit, okay? So in that case, there's something tangible that you could come and sue me. Mm-hmm. Take me to the Besdin, right? And you say, look, he hit me. And it cost me $50 in the doctor's bill, okay?
So,
right. I lost the week, that's even more, right. Correct. I mean, all these things would add up, okay? All right. Salomon, right. So that already knows a substantial amount. But what if I hit you, you didn't lose any work, and all that I did was to cause you, let's say, maybe to put on a Band-Aid or something like that.
What does pruta mean?
A pruta is a small coin. Okay, it's a small coin. I mean, it's more than a penny, but let's say it's the equivalent of about a dime, a quarter, or something like that, okay? So let's say that the only damage that I inflicted upon you is that you had to go and put a Band-Aid on. Okay? That's all. You had to put a Band-Aid on. And the Band-Aid didn't cost a pruta. You understand? All right. So, if it had been at least a pruta's worth, then there's something to go to court for, and so on and so on. You get a judgment. But what if he hits you, and it's only a very, very minor thing, since not? The Omer Rav Ami, Omer Rav Yochanan. As Rav Ami said in the name of Rav Yochanan, he said, that if a person strikes another one, and the damage is very, very minimal, it's not even a pruta's worth, nevertheless, he has to be punished. Because where does it say that you have the privilege of hitting
somebody else?
Not allowed to hit somebody, right? Yeah. So in that particular case, the court can punish you by giving you malchus, okay? And then he says, "Velo makshinon hakol eklala." In the final analysis, we do not make a comparison between a blow and, you know, hitting somebody, and between cursing. They're two different categories, and judge them separately. All right. Then the Mishnah concluded by it saying, if you remember, getting back again, it says, "Veger toshav," right? The ger toshav eino gole, right? He doesn't go into exile el al yedei ger toshav, unless he struck or he killed inadvertently another ger toshav, right? So if that's the case, almo we see it says that ger toshav ovit kechovimhu, that a ger toshav is still considered in the category of being a goy, an idolater. Not a fellow Jew, but like that. Remember, he's not the Ger Tzedek. He's not the
right.
He's not the convert. But we're talking about only
that
this person,
the
right?
Abed, Kanani, but Kanani.
The Abed Kanani has to undergo. He's more of a Jew because of the fact that he was circumcised.
Right.
He was immersed in the mikveh. He's commanded to perform all kinds of mitzvahs, except, as we said, you know, mitzvahs ashrei she'hizman gromo, right?
Okay.
Not only that, but the Torah says specifically in reference to Shabbos, you know, ator, v'incho, v'techo, v'avdecho, v'amasecho, right? And ashrei, who we're talking about, not talking about the Eved Ivri, talking about the Eved Kanani, that even he too is not allowed to work for you on Shabbos. Not allowed.
Your toshav is really just a like
call him a resident alien.
Yeah, right.
Resident alien. He has a green card.
Right. He's living among you.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Right. But under any circumstance, you wouldn't allow anybody to work for you on Shabbos.
You're correct. You're not allowed even to tell a goy to do anything for you on Shabbos, because this we derive, you know, from Yeshayahu. Where he speaks also about.
Well, what if you hire him before Shabbos to do it? You know, like put a shovel of coal out of the furnace during the day.
No.
You can't do that either?
If he comes and does the work by himself without without you telling him to do it on Shabbos itself, it would be permitted, provided, you know, it's the type of a thing that is required for good health, and safety, whatever it may be. In other words,
But you wouldn't allow somebody to come and cut your grass on Shabbos.
Right.
Okay.
You want hot tea on Shabbos. You're not allowed for Delagoy come into my house, put on the fire so I can have hot tea. Not allowed. Okay? That you can't do.
You mean before Shabbos you can't tell them. You can't tell them to do that before Shabbos.
On Shabbos you're not allowed to tell them. Okay. If he came and you had an arrangement with him beforehand that he could do it, then technically you might be able. It's not right, but technically you may not be in violation. Okay, but that's not the way you should operate.
I wouldn't give you a malchus for that, but we'll let you advise.
Right. But let's say if it's a matter of we need light in the shul on Shabbos. Okay, otherwise it's going to be hard to daven. So in that particular case, we could make arrangements, that Ray, the janitor, should come in and put on the lights. And if he sees, that it's not enough, if it's cold in the shul, in the winter time, when everybody is liable to write, so you give him permission, that also he could put on the heat for you.
The Shabbos guard.
Okay.
Shabbos guard.
Exactly. But under normal circumstances, you can't tell him to do this, that, or the other. If you can hint, it's better to do it in a roundabout way than in a direct way.
It would be nice if it was warmer in here, so you have to go get the...
I think was it Rabbi Tarfon, in the Talmud they have the story of where he was on a ship, correct me if I'm wrong, and they lowered a gangplank. I'm not sure it's Tarfon. And so... The question is, was he allowed, was this right for to walk down the gangplank because someone had lowered the gangplank for him walk? And he said
Shabbos,
if it was for...
You're talking about docking a ship on Shabbos and the passengers. Are they allowed to get off? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I thought this also pertained to this because this question that the sailor was doing this not just for Rabbi Tarfon, but
he was doing it for himself.
Or for the entire...
If he's doing it for himself, there may be some justification for you to take advantage of.
Right.
There may be. Okay?
Or for all
it shouldn't
of
be done, but it is a possibility. Okay? In other words, if, let's say, the goy should not make a samovar on Shabbos for you. Okay? Should not. Samovar should be already prepared before Shabbos itself. And that's it, period. But if, let's say, for some reason or other, a goy put on the fire in order to make something for himself, and he made enough water so that if a Jew said, could I have a little hot water? So it might be permissible as long as the goy was the primary recipient and this was his own primary advantage, if you say. Okay? But these are really technicalities, I don't have to tell you. We know what the spirit of Shabbos is. Spirit of Shabbos is that, in general, what you are not permitted to do, you have no permission to tell a goy to do for you. This is the real spirit of Shabbos, okay? And as I said, it comes from Yeshayahu, where it says that, the Karasa la Shabbos Oineg, you should call the Sabbath the day of delight, right? Minso Chefzecho, so that you don't do what you normally would want to do, the Daber Dovo, or to give words even, to tell somebody. You shouldn't. The Daber Dovo could refer to many things. Many people, said that there's a Gemara that says, that your conversation on Shabbos, should not be like your conversation during the week.
Everything
should not be in secret school.
Right, how can you call it the day of delight?
But it also applies to this.
If the fire goes out and you're freezing on Shabbos.
Then in that case, that's already a different story. As I say, it's a matter of health. So in that case, you could, because the possibility is that, that if you catch pneumonia, it'll be worse.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. So then you could tell the goy to come and to do it for you. Okay.
You run to the rope and play it silent.
Exactly. I mean, don't make your own generalizations.
No.
I mean, you should ask permission from a rope, of course. No question. Right. All right. So, Let's see. Let's throw a couple of more lines and we'll call it a night over here. All right, so it says, Almor Ger Tosha Vevet Kochovim, right? In other words, we are comparing then this Ger Koshov to that of an idolater. This is what it would look like, right? So, Amor Sefer, so what about what it says afterwards, that Ger Toshav Gola Al Yedei Ger Toshav, that, you know, if a Ger Toshav inadvertently kills another Ger Toshav, he goes into Golas? Why should he go into Golas? Golas should be reserved for only Jews, right? And not for somebody who you equated with idolatry, right? So we see that in this particular case, then, that the Ger Toshav does have a semi-status, which is somewhat similar to that of a Jew, even though he's not a Jew. Okay, somewhere Rav Kahna, so Rav Kahna says Leikasha, it's not a kasha. It says Kan the Ger Toshav Sharag Ger Toshav. In one case, we are talking about a Ger Toshav who killed another Ger Toshav. But Kan Beger Toshav Sharag Yisrael. But the other case we're talking about, a Ger Toshav who killed a Jew. What is the difference between them? It says, so for this we'll take a look at the Rashi. It says, Chutz Beger Toshav over there, and so, you know, when it gets, the lines get a little bit smaller over there. Okay. We see from both of these that actually we're trying to make an exclusion. The lohu gola yedei hariga, so ela neherag. Interesting how Rashi says. He says that if a if we say that he's like a goy, okay, then in that particular case, and you know, somebody who is an idolater does not go into exile, but rather he deserves to be executed by the court. Why? So this goes back to an opinion that we find in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, to the effect that the Bnei Noach, their punishment for any infraction of law was to be put to death. And so this guy, who is after all committed to observe the B'nai Noach, then if he should commit, even if he should happen to kill another one, okay, then in that particular case he should not go into Golis, but rather he should get the death penalty.
But this we're talking about is
right, right.
Is inadvertent killing?
Huh? Inadvertent, right, right. Even for inadvertent killing. Of course, that's not what the law is. But this is what Rashi is suggesting, how the argument is running right now.
Right.
The law Yisrael, Gola, love. And likewise, he says, a Jew is not going to have to go into Golis if he inadvertently killed him. Now, of course, this is contrary to what we learned just before on the previous page, so that therefore obviously it has to be straightened out. So he says Lo Kasha, he says no, it's not really a Kasha. He says Ger Toshav Shaharag Ger Toshav Gola, just as we have learned, the Ger Toshav who killed another Ger Toshav, he does get Golas Kidakotani Behedya, as we learned specifically, right? The Reisha Shaharag is Yisrael Eino Gola. But the first part of the Baraisa that we're quoting, that if he killed a Jew, so he does not go into Golos. Why? The Loisagi lay the Golos, because Golos is not good enough for him. In other words, he deserves more severe penalty, and you know, not to have the advantage of Golas, which, as we've said time and again, Golas serves in general two purposes. One of them is that it protects him from the Goel Hadom,
right, from people walking
right, and the other one is that it gives him an opportunity for Kapora, gives him an opportunity to atone for his sins. He should be over there and repent and realize that he did wrong, and he should repent, you see. And this person, you know, if he killed a Jew and he was Ger Toshav, then he doesn't deserve Golus because of the fact, A, he should be prepared at any moment to face the punishment of the Goyal Hadom. And secondly, he doesn't deserve Kapora for what he did. Okay. All right, we'll stop at this particular point and continue over here from the top of page 10. Next week, next week is Erev Thanksgiving. I'm willing to come and to learn if you're willing to come and learn. Okay? All right, so we'll learn at our usual time at 7:30. Very good. Right. Yeah. Good.
So you're on.
Okie dokie. All right.
Tess?
Yep. All right, we're on Tess right now, Omid Aleph, and we start from the third line on the page over there. Kutz me'al yedei ger toshav and so on. All right, so says Alma. So we see then from the discussion that ger toshav is oved kechovim hu, that the ger toshav is considered like being an idolater. Instead of being considered, you know, like, let's say, I wouldn't say a half Jew. All right, let's say a half Jew in the sense only, you know, that he has permission to live in Eretz Israel, and he's not, one of the conditions is that he's not worshipping Avodah Zarah. Mm-hmm. And yet here we equate him with somebody who actually does worship Avodah Zarah. So this would be, of course, you know, based on the idea that he's not allowed, you know, to get Golas. You know, that was the last statement that we made. On the other hand, so he says, Amor Sefer, so look, he says, let's take a look again. What did the Mishnah say towards the end? It said, Ger Toshav Gole Adidei Ger Toshav, right?
Mm.
That if he is the Ger Toshav, then he will go into exile if he happened to kill another Ger Toshav. So Amar Rav Kana, Rav Kana says, is Leikashi, he says, there's no difficulty. Why? Because we're dealing with two different cases. He says, Khan Begir Toshav, Shehorag Be'er Toshav, and Khan Begir Toshav, Shehorag Yisrael. Talking in the first instance, of course, is the instance of the Mishnah, where it says that if a Ger Toshav kills another Ger Toshav, of course we're talking about an Eretz Israel, so in that case he is entitled to the protection of going to the Ir Miklot, okay, to the city of Revelot. Okay.
Golis.
But on the other hand, right, which is Golis, right. On the other hand, if a Ger Toshav killed an Israel, so then he's not allowed to go into, you know, the Ir Miklot, even as we said before. Okay. So, Iko de Rome, there are those who explain the same machlokes in a somewhat different way by comparing Kroya Hadode, by comparing Psukim in the Torah and comparing them to see, you know, that if there is, let's say, a contradiction between these two Psukim. What are the Psukim? So, one Pasuk says, the Bnei Yisroel, Vilagir, Vilatoshov, Besochav, Tiyena Sheshorim, and so on. In other words, these six cities shall be as a refuge. They didn't quote the entire Pasuk, you know. Tiyena Sheshorim, Oela Lemiklot, you know. So, these six cities are to be set aside as cities of refuge, not only for Bnei Yisroel, for the children of Israel, but it also says, Vilagir. Now, who is the Ger over here that we're talking about?
Ger Toshav.
No, we're talking about the Ger Tzedek. In other words, the proselyte, the person who was not born Jewish, but who became Jewish, right? And then Vilat Toshav B'Seicham. And also for the Toshav, who in this case is the Ger Toshav, as we said. In other words, he did not accept Judaism, but at the same time, he did swear off being an idolater. Okay. Uchsiv, and the other pasuk says, "Vayulochem heorim lemiklot," that these cities shall be unto you for a refuge. Now, of course, men could always argue, you know, that the way the pasuk runs, it means, you know, that for all these people, for all of you, you know, this shall be a refuge. But this is not the way we derive a drash. Looking for a drash, then the word lochem becomes very, very significant. Namely, lochem velo lagerim. In other words, it is for you, in other words, for you, for Jews, in other words, it would be an ir miklot, but not lagerim. Right. And of course, this business, you know, lochem, meaning you and excluding others, I mean, this is, we find out in many, many places. Just as, for example, we had in another case, lo, says lo unto him, and not to somebody else, and so on and so forth, you see. So, for example, well, I was going to say, for example, what we have, you know, it's written concerning the lulav, the esrog, you know, there it says, lokachtem lochem bayom rishon, you have to take unto yourselves. So from this we derive all kinds of dinim just from the word lochem. Lochem means it has to be mishalochem, in other words, it has to belong to you. In other words, you bought it for yourself, okay? And this, therefore, on the first day, it excludes, for example, a borrowed lulav, unless, you know, the person tells you, I'm giving this to you as a matona, that you may return to me afterwards, or something like that, you know. So the word lochem very often, you know, is interpreted with a very specific way. So this is what it is over here. Lochem, yeah, for you who are Jews, right. But, you know, for Beger, in this particular case, Beger meaning not the the proselyte, as we said, but rather the Ger Tosha, he is excluded. So obviously, in one case we say, he does go into Golas. In the next case, we say he doesn't go into Golas. So how do we reconcile the two? So Omer Rav Kana, so Rav Kana said, Lekashi, he says, no, it's not a difficulty. Why? He says, because Kan Begir Teshuv Shoharak Yisrael, and Kan Begir Teshuv Shoharak Ger Teshuv. In other words, in the case, you know, where he is excluded from going into Golas, we says that's where he killed an Israelite. But where the Ger Toshav is permitted to go into Golas, then that's where he killed. Of course, I'm talking about, you know, inadvertently, you know, that he killed another Ger Toshav, okay? Baramin, who? And now they ask Akasha about this. It says, L'fichach, if that's the case, we come to the conclusion that what? That Ger, the Yevet Kechovim Shehargu Ne'erogim. If we say that this is really a little bit thumb twisting, right? Good evening, Sam. Good evening. I'll wait until you are seated, you find a place. Okay.
Yes. Got it.
Yeah. For this, we're going to have to take a look at the Rashi in another moment. But first, let me just say what the text says, okay? It says over there, Lepicha, for this reason, Ger, the Yoveit Kacham, in other words, a Ger Tosha and an idolater, if they killed somebody, of course, again, remember, if they killed somebody accidentally, so Ne'erogim, they ought to be put to death. They say, put to death? How could it happen? So let's take a look first at the Rashi. Okay? Yeah. Where it says, Lepichoch. That's, I don't know, maybe it's about 10 lines going down. Okay?
Yeah,
see Lepichoch in the middle over there?
Yeah.
It says, for that reason, he says, Asheva mitzvah is talbim b'nei noyachai. He says, at this particular moment, the reference is here to the seven mitzvos that, you know, the descendants of Noah were commanded. Now, naturally, what is one of the mitzvos that they agreed? One of the mitzvahs they agreed is that they would not be shevich damim, right? In other words, shvichus damim, as we say, bloodshed. Okay? If they killed somebody, then that's one of the things that they were commanded that it's wrong, and therefore they should be punished. So the Chaim alone, and we have a tradition, he says, that as harason zuhi misason, that the very fact that they are being warned about the fact that they should not shed blood, even inadvertently, of course, is the idea. So this is the reason why they deserve the death penalty. Okay? Lefichach, therefore, for that reason, ger toshav, o ove kachovim shen horgu, if they killed somebody, then they are rogim, then they are to be killed. Va'afilu b'shegeg, even if they did so inadvertently, by mistake, by error, right? She'ein b'nei noach tzarichim hasroach, because the B'nai Noach do not require Hasra. Now remember, we said that a Jew requires Hasra. If you want to inflict the death penalty upon a Jew, then you have to warn him of the fact that he is committing a crime where the punishment will be the death penalty, and he also has to say, and I don't give a damn about it, I'm going to go ahead and do it, and so on. He's not so, you know, in the presence of the witnesses who warned him. Right, this is Hasra. But says Rashi, of course, it's based upon a Gemara and Sanhedrin, where the feeling is over there that the B'nai Noach do not have this principle of Azhar, in other words, of Hasra, or Azhar, it's the same thing, in other words, to give warning that, you know, it's wrong, and therefore you're going to be
down the wrong
right.
path.
Right. Okay. So in that case, we see then that if this is so, then we are equating the ger and the yovei kechovim, right? Katone ger, we learn the ger toshav, the principle about the ger toshav, namely that he too is to be put to death if he inadvertently causes the death of somebody else, right? Dum yovei kechovim. And we say that it's similar to the case of an idolater. Ma oved kechovim, just as in the case of an idolater, lo shno de kotol ba'minei v'lo shno de kotol de la ba'minei, it makes no difference, lo shno de kotol, whether he killed someone who is ba'minei, which means literally the same species, literally, in other words, fellow ger or a fellow idolater, right? Velo shno, and it makes no difference, the kotal de la b'minei, whether he killed, the person who he killed was not, you know, the same as he. In other words, I say, like, he killed a Jew, okay? It is. And what is his punishment? If he killed, neharag, he's to be put to death. So, av ger, just as in the case of the roi kachavim, so we say, likewise then, that a ger, again the ger toshav, leishno, makes no difference, the kotol barminei, the leishno, the kotol, the lav barminei, makes no difference whether he killed a fellow ger toshav or not, right? Ne'arag is to be put to death. Now, obviously, this is a contradiction to what we said, that if he killed another ger toshav, he goes into the galus. Obviously, you do not inflict the death penalty upon him. So, there's obviously a contradiction between them. Well, of course, we can argue, you know, that on the basis of logic, we can take an extreme position. But when it comes to reality, there's already a different mindset. We don't necessarily inflict the death penalty simply on the basis of, you know, let's say, what shall I say, logic or something like that. Or as the Gemara would say in another place, it says, you know, ein rogin mipnei hadin. Mipnei hadin means the same thing again. That din, in this case, means like logical reasoning. Okay? On the basis of logical reasoning alone, you cannot inflict a death penalty.
Okay,
we had it even earlier, by the way, in the first chapter, that you're not allowed to even give malchus just on the basis of logical reasoning. The Torah has to be specific in what it, you know, it warns a person, you know, as to what cases a person deserves malchus. But simply on the basis that you're going to use logical reasoning, that alone is not sufficient. Omar Rav Chisda, so Rav Chisda said, Lei Kasha. He said, whoa, no Kasha, no difficulty, whatever. What? Kan Shehorgu Derech Yavido, Kan Shehorgu Derech Aliyah. He brings in a new element. What is the element this time? Well, if you remember, we said before that if a person kills somebody accidentally and it's through a downward thrust or a downward motion or something like that, then we said what? It goes into Golas, right? Whereas if it's a result of an upward motion or going up a ladder or something like that, as we had the illustration, then in that particular case we say that, you know, he is excused. You remember, because that was considered already something that could not have been foreseen, whereas the other one, there was an element of danger which was involved, and therefore if it happened, but again, you know, not intentionally, but simply that it happened that way, so because of the risk factor being greater that way, so therefore he goes into Golas. Alright. So Rav Chisda now introduces this business. He says, like Kashi, says, Kan Shehorgu Derech Yavido, Kan Shehorgu Derech Aliyah. Derech Yavido, but you'll see, he gives us some parkerot, as we'll see in a second. Derech Yavido, the Yisroel, right? Gali. Right? In other words, if a Jew, for example, killed another Jew, right? That was going, you know, the downward way. Then in that case, we say, golly, he goes into exile, right? But Ihu Name, Sagile Begolus, right? So he likewise, he should also receive the same consideration. If the other one is Derech Yavido, then he also should go into Golas if the accident occurred, you know, through Derech Yavido, right? Derech Aliyah, the Israel Potter, right? If on the other hand, you know, the Jew, let's say, if a Jew killed inadvertently as a result of going up or making an upward stroke or something like that, then in that case we say what? He is Potter, right? He doesn't go into Golas. So, who neharag? This guy, the Ger Toshav, this is the way he did it. He is to be put to death.
It's not logical.
Yeah. So I'm Amalai Rava. So Rava said to him, probably should be Rava, but that's all right. Doesn't matter. Balav Kalvachomer. Who? Isn't this a Kalvachomer? In other words, couldn't you figure it out by logical reasoning? Right? That inasmuch as if it were with a downward motion, then an Israelite who killed inadvertently that way would go into Golas. So he too, he should also get Golas. And Derech Aliyah the Israel Potter, Ihu Ne'erak. Are you going to tell me that he should be put to death if it was Derech Aliyah when an Israelite that way is Potter? Hello, I'm a Rava, but Rava says, Rava, no. The case is not about Derech Aliyah or Derech Yavido. Not that, he says. He says, it's a different case. The case that we're talking about over here is Be'omer Mutar, where a person says, I thought it was permissible to kill. Of course, again, we're not necessarily talking about, you know, to kill deliberately, but no. You know, it's okay. I mean, it happens. That's all. Right, by Mamuta. So Omale Abaye. So Abaye said to Rava, he said to him, "Look, Eimer Mutar Onasu. If a person says, I thought that it was permissible, in that case, then he is considered as being honest. Honest in this case means, you know, that, that it happened accidentally, and he didn't know any better. And in that particular case, what is the punishment to be? The punishment would be that he doesn't go into exile, because he didn't know that that was it. So this is I don't have to take again. This is the way Abaye would interpret.
Because he said he didn't think he got it from his law.
I'm innocent. I didn't know. I didn't know that there was a law against it, or something like that. Yeah.
But you're saying ignorance of the law exonerates him.
Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily. As we'll see in a second. So Omale. So he said to him as a rejoinder. He said, "Look, Shani Omer. Look, what I'm telling you is as follows. Omer Mutar." Korov l'meizid, that if a person says, and I thought that, you know, if it was permissible, then he is a korov l'meizid, which we already explained previously several weeks ago, that the element of negligence there is so bad that it almost would seem that he was deliberately courting such an accident. And if that's the case, then we say that he does not get golus. Why? Because, as we said before, he doesn't deserve golus, neither from the aspect of kapora, nor from the aspect of finding a refuge from the goel adom. So that's what I mean, he says, when I say, you know, potter, I don't mean that, you know, he's scot-free. But I mean that he doesn't deserve even, you know, this, the kapara, that, or the protection, you know, that being in the Yer Miklat. And the Gemara continues and says, V'yos l'tamayhu. And both Abaye and Rabbah over here, they are following their logical reasoning, because there are other cases, too, where they have similar differences of opinion and similar stance. The Itmar, as we have learned. Kosovor Behemom Benim Sa'odom. What if he was under the impression that, you know, let's say when he took aim at an animal, right? He thought it was an animal, but instead, who did he hit? He hit a human being, okay. Or Kenani, he thought that he was aiming at a Canaanite. Benim Sa'ger Toshov. And instead, he happened to hit a Ger Tosha. So, in that particular case, Rava Omer Chayov. So Rava says that, you know, he deserves, that he is guilty, and he deserves, therefore, going into Golos. Yeah, but I mean, the chayav is not necessarily over here, you see, because of the fact that the chayav also, you know, could mean that, you know, he deserves maybe the death penalty, okay? Let's take a look at the Rashi for one moment over there. He says, Ba'im Mutar, you see? First of all, Ba'im Mutar, he says, Ne'arag. That, you know, a person who says the same, he should be put to death, allowed by Golas, because he doesn't deserve Golas, right? And then it says, V'yosu Tamayu, they were both going to live. Now, in this case, it says it's not Abaye and Rava, but rather it's Rav Chisda and Rava in this case. Rav Chisda, the Leiboy, the Shinui, the Imam Mutar, that Rav Chisda does not want to accept this idea of Imam Mutar, because Sovar. Onusu, because he's of the opinion that in that case he really is, you know, that it's accidental, it's not deliberate, and that if he doesn't deserve the penalty. But Robert Omanerag, Robert was the one who feels that he should be put to death. Kosovra Behemo, so he says, Hareze Kerma Mutar, right? If a person says, I thought it was an animal that I was aiming at, right? So this is the same as saying Muta. I thought that is right. Shehoyelo lilbo, right? because he should have studied the situation better. Literally, he should have learned the laws a lot better than he did. And therefore, if he does it, then in that particular case, it's not that he's going to go off scot-free, but as we said before, he really would deserve a death penalty, but we're not going to inflict a death penalty. On the other hand, what? We're not going to give him Golas Eden. He doesn't deserve it. In other words, he has to take his chances with the Goel Hadom. Okay? The Abzeh Hoyalola Ayeh. In this case, too, he should have looked into it. Uveger Toshav Askin. In other words, and this applies also to Ger Toshav. Okay? So Chayav, he says, Chayav Misa. He deserves the death penalty, he says. And Omer Mutar is Korol Lemezetu. So that this is the opinion of Rabbah.